Welcome, everyone. This is the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, October 7th, 2006. As you know, we are weekly from 3 to 4 in the afternoon, Eastern Time in the United States. And I will be your host today, Marcia Mary Baker. I'm with the economic section of the Executive Intelligence Review News Service. The guests we have today are off-site, and we're very pleased they could be with us from Berlin, Germany, and Seattle, Washington. I want to identify and welcome them and then just say a few introductory things about some breaking news developments and then go right to the discussion we're having, which is on the topic, as you may have seen from our website, of the isotope economy. But we'll get to that very deeply in just a moment, but I'm so glad we could have the author of a paper now circulating by that name, Jonathan Tenenbaum. Welcome in Berlin.
Thank you.
Good connection. And from the LaRouche Youth Movement, and there are other things I'd like to say about him in a minute, but from Seattle, Peter Martinson, are you there?
Yeah, good to be with you.
Welcome, gentlemen, very much. What I want people to understand when I mention this this title of this article, The Isotope Economy, which you'll find posted on the LaRouche Publications website. You know that's laRouchePub.com, and it's in the October 6th issue of our weekly EIR in print, the October 6th issue. What this is a discussion document of some very important fundamental, you can call it scientific economics, economic science, but in any case, the what you want to think about before the next international webcast that Mr. Lyndon LaRouche is having. It will be October 31st, and that's a scary time to scare the evil people in the world for Halloween. But it's in Berlin and Washington, D.C. simultaneously. That means we're planning on 10 a.m. Eastern Time in the United States and 16 hours or 4 p.m. in Berlin time. And that will be an opportunity for direct dialogue there or to continue and to continue what already is an international dialogue about the direction of the world at this time of great crisis. And part of the world crisis that I'm referring to is the situation where what direction will the United States go in? We have features of our present-day situation that involve a potential military strike on Iran. People who are following anything know what the signs and signals of that may be. That is, the Cheney-Bush alignment in the White House could do that kind of thing. Their backers could say do it, and they could follow along. We have the financial system of the world in a process of disintegration. It's dramatic. That's not our topic for today. But in the midst of this, it's no time to have any politics as usual. And I think that some people may have on their mind what they've seen in the headlines around the world with the kind of Shakespearean development of expose of depravity on Capitol Hill and cover up by the Republican Party. Again, that's not our topic today, but the issue is what will citizens do here in the United States to take the opportunity to turn things around even before the November 7th midterm elections? What will people do in other parts of the world in the midst of this crisis? And that's why we have our guests on today, whom we'll get to in just a second. But that's why I stress, participate, plan to listen live or otherwise be in touch with the October 31st webcast by Mr. LaRouche, which is titled World Crisis on Eve of the U.S. General Election. And in that regard, let me just tell you a couple breaking things about the initiatives of the LaRouche Youth Movement and Mr. LaRouche. Lynn LaRouche was on just a couple hours ago with a whole youth gathering in California. They're on a retreat for a weekend cadre school. And so he was able they had a whole discussion which just took place. So Mr. LaRouche is keeping busy. And here in the EIR Publication Center. I just want to say what's being, it's literally the presses are being held on Columbus Day weekend in order to accommodate some dynamite material on the way in which an aspect of what you could call the secret government within the government of the United States, that is, people who, we've used the name John Train. He's a famous New York City investment banker connected with kind of international synarchist banking networks, but capabilities connected to people like this man John Train that over the decades they've literally had a Get LaRouche task force. They've also gone after other political figures who question the doctrines like perpetual war of the U.S. government. And they've been going on campuses in the last few years, especially recent months, to hit any discussion among young people or among faculty that questions some of the neoconservative or the synarchist banking interests. I mean that literally. And a bunch of dirty networks have been set up, including by Dick Cheney's wife, Mrs. Lynn Cheney, who's been very active in all this. And so there's an expose dossier being prepared. I don't have a title for it, that names the names, says who the networks are that have been putting out defamatory articles, slanders, doing dirty tricks, goes into these organizations. One of them, Lynn Cheney's organization, she's connected to something called the American Council of Trustees and Alumni. It's called ACTA. She's also connected to something called FIRE, F-I-R-E, Foundation for Individual Rights and Education, which is just Gestapo operations that are part of a kind of interlock that from Boston to Seattle and operating internationally too, have been running interference for literally fascist policies. So this will be out online on the EIR publication site, that's LaRouchePub.com, that would be around Tuesday, about the 10th, in the weekly EIR online, and it will be out in the EIR print weekly this coming week and ready to go like wildfire. I understand that the LaRouche Political Action Committee plans to get something out on a rush basis, a mass pamphlet in the United States. So that's the nature of this intervention, and I recommend people activate and contribute resources, know it's coming, and stay tuned to that especially. It's what can make all the difference in activating citizens again in this country. And with that, what I'd like to do is just turn to the topic that we have at hand. Let me just put it this way. If this weekend we could find that we woke up to the news that President Bush and Dick Cheney had resigned, that Mr. Hastert had stepped aside as Speaker of the House so he wouldn't head the government, that a special emergency grouping was formed in the Senate to consult with Mr. LaRouche and take action. Wouldn't that be something? But what would we do then? What kind of policies? Mr. LaRouche has been discussing what kind of financial and many other policies with people and national leaders around the world. But what should we do about this agenda for mankind in the way of science and economics? In some ways, it's on the highest level, we need a kind of FDR-style vision for a worldwide New Deal and a rejuvenation of science. And that's what brings our guests with us today. And Jonathan, just before I turn it over to you, I'd like people to think for a moment to get in the right mindset, I guess, about these fantastic photographs that we just got available on a lot of our televisions around the world from the rover up on Mars. I think it's the one called Opportunity that's sending back fantastic color photographs, and you seem to see layered rocks, sedimentary deposits. Maybe there's a geochemical history there of water. Have you seen these, Jonathan?
Not yet. I've seen a lot of the earlier ones.
Well, there's a new
Not
set.
The ones just on.
There's a new set, and some of your listeners will have seen this. So this takes us, kind of lifts our eyes to the heavens, and that brings us to the fact that you summarized in this document called The Isotope Economy, where we should be going. Why don't you describe why you wrote it and just start us off?
Okay. Well, I think I'm sure the regular listeners are aware of the fact that that we're in a very big mess. The world is in a mess. And this Lyndon LaRouche as a leading U.S. figure is in day-to-day discussion with leading circles around the world about what to do about it. And my work is a contribution to that. The webcast on the 6th of September, people look, it's well documented in the EIR, will see some of how that dialogue is working. Now, I'm addressing in the paper on the isotope economy something which is very relevant to the differences between our situation right now and, let us say, the problems that Franklin Roosevelt faced in launching an economic recovery in the United States when he took office. At that point, you had a depression in the United States, but there were massive industrial capabilities. There was a workforce that was largely demoralized but still had skills to a significant extent. You had still a relatively short period of shutting down of capabilities in the United States. We have a situation now, which is not just in the United States. It's Western Europe. It's Japan. It's in different ways large sections of developing countries. But if we look at the United States, the United States and other formerly industrial nations have suffered a period of over three decades of systematic destruction of the in-depth scientific and industrial capability upon which the future of mankind depends. So that you can't simply say, okay, let's spend a lot of money, let's just build things. Of course, we have to build major infrastructure projects, which we've spoken about, something like what the FDR was doing, but that's not going to be sufficient. You need a science driver, what LaRouche has called as a major part of his policy generally, a science driver. You need a mobilization. And I'm very happy at the title of the youth movement publication, Dunamis, which was appearance is very good news because it touches on the kind of concept that you need. Namely, you need something which will transform the U.S. and other industrial economies together with the rising developing sector economies very dramatically to have a cultural impact, to have an impact on a reindustrialization. So that what you were mentioning, Marcia, about the John Train, about if you look at what's documented in the EIR and elsewhere about what was done to these capabilities, we're not simply at the end of a stagnation period, but we're at the end of a period of real destruction by these circles, and not only destruction of physical capabilities, but especially destruction of the minds and what we call labor power of the population. So from that standpoint, I looked and say, okay, where do we get this mobilization? And it's a fact that if we look back in history, and you look at what was the last really fundamental scientific revolution, it was associated with the development of nuclear energy and nuclear science. And Vernadsky saw that. This was, in a sense, the story of Prometheus, the concept of Prometheus, who gave fire, the use of fire the principle of fire to mankind. In a sense, the discoveries made in the area of nuclear physics, which grew out of Mendeleev's conception, which was again itself grew out of Kepler's work, conception of the harmonic ordering of the universe, Vernadsky realized that a new era was emerging of a very fundamental change in the relationship of man to the universe, not simply in our relationship to the Earth or some specific issue part of the Earth. So And the point that's what led into nuclear energy. But nuclear energy, as we know it now, is only, let's say, a very first kind of spin-off. It's not, for reasons which we could go into later, indicated in the paper, this revolution, this fundamental revolution, which Vernadsky associated with the coming into being of what he called the noosphere, was massively attacked from the oligarchical side, and the anti-nuclear campaign, the 68 revolution and so forth, which is very closely interconnected, was not by accident directed against this revolution to try to nip it in the bud. So what I'm proposing in the paper is exactly to relaunch that revolution and to use for this purpose the fact that we do have, despite the enormous destruction of in-depth scientific capabilities, if you look at the world, if you put together the nuclear science, nuclear technology capabilities, including areas which are directly related to nuclear science, which include astrophysics, they include space research, they include certain areas of medicine and biology, they include areas of geology. It's all linked together. If you look at that capability still there, that's a capability which can be mobilized. And the, let's say, just to put it in a certain way that may communicate to the listeners the revolutionary character of this, what you can say is that this mobilization will involve a conception of man relative to the universe, which has always been there, but it's brought out in a very important way by the isotope economy, namely that man is a universal being. Man is not a terrestrial being. Man is not even just a solar system being. We are universal beings. We are astrophysical. And that means that with respect to the revolution in nuclear energy, our universe runs on what you might call nuclear energy. When we're talking about nuclear power, when we're talking about the development of fusion, we're talking about actually man carrying out activities here on the Earth which are otherwise the kinds of processes which the development of the universe is based on. So now this paper actually grew out of a long process when, in 1974, Lyndon LaRouche founded the Fusion Energy Foundation. We had a dialogue involving leading physicists, leading researchers in the area, particularly of nuclear fusion, but also in other areas of science. You mentioned Professor Robert Moon in particular. We had seminars going into the 80s. We had the publication Fusion Magazine, which was a very important institution in the United States. And we had, in certain ways, a dialogue which is now being very much revived in the recent period, as you can see from the September 6th webcast, as just an example, a dialogue with leading thinkers in Russia about how to launch a new industrial scientific drive, a new science driver. So I took the developments that have been going on, despite the suppression of scientific progress, which is not 100%. You have very important developments going on. You have in France, for example, the ITER, which is a fusion reactor, is now under construction. You have very important work going on in China, even on fusion. You have breakthroughs in the area, which is of great interest, and which I include in the paper at least some indications on, in the significance of the subatomic organization of the universe for life. Or to put it differently, when I said we want to look at man as a universal being, then man looking at the universe, we're looking at a universe which is organized by ideas. The universe runs on ideas, and it runs on principles. And you can see that we're acting right now when we talk about resources, when we talk about energy and so forth. What are we really doing? We're acting on a universe that has a certain history. And as Vernadsky emphasize, if you look at the universe, you see three fundamental levels of principles or classes of principles, which are operating, they're universal principles, they're operating everywhere in the universe at the same time. You have the principles that govern the so-called non-organic or ostensibly non-living matter. You might say the rocks and stones of the Earth's crust. You have the principles that govern living processes, and then you have principles which pertain to those processes which depend upon human reason. And these are operating. You say we have our bodies. Those bodies appear to be composed of elements. They are living processes, and then you have a higher principle operating through us, a principle of reason. So you have these three levels or manifolds. It is very important for the isotope economy to realize that when we look at life in the biosphere on this planet, life is operating with elements, chemical elements, that were pre-created, that were created out of an evolutionary process of the development of the solar system, the creation of the Earth, which is not simply an ordinary, what you might call, inorganic process. I've suggested the name nucleosphere in analogy with biosphere and noosphere, that you have each of these three principles is evolutionary. So we're operating, we have man up to now, basically, up to the advent of nuclear energy, basically operating in a chemical mode where we use the elements as we find them, and we dig them up, the ones that we use in the form of resources, as they're given. Now, with the advent of nuclear energy, what are you talking about? You're talking about astrophysics. You're talking about the processes which billions of years ago generated the chemical elements that we now, in a sense, revive, but in a transformed way, those processes, well, the processes are going on all over the universe astrophysically, in order to create resources for further development of mankind. So we're interacting in a different way, and are moving into a period where the economy becomes astrophysical, and where one key element of this is that most people think about, well, nuclear energy. Nuclear energy is nuclear power plants, fission power plants, produce electricity, let us say, and heat, which we want to have. But then you have this terrible stuff, people think, called nuclear waste. But if you really think scientifically about what a nuclear reactor is, it is a transmutation machine. In that nuclear reactor, you take uranium, for example, or thorium, and through nuclear processes, there are created, we call it waste, but that's the wrong word for it, there are created essentially a stock of elements distributed across the periodic table, including significant amounts of some of the most valuable metals and other materials, which we otherwise mine at great expense from the Earth's core. Substances like rhodium that's much more valuable than gold. So now we begin to say, okay, now what are we doing? What man is beginning to do is to create elements, to create resources. And a group of Japanese researchers remarked that if you look at the content in so-called nuclear waste of valuable materials, that nuclear waste is one of the most spectacularly valuable ores for industrial resources that you can find anywhere. So, therefore, I'm looking at a technological development which has two aspects. One is what I just said, the generation, the creation of species of atoms, and the second is a moving in productive activity to what appear to be very fine differences. And that's where you get to the concept of isotope. The fact that when we talk about oxygen, for example, or the oxygen that we're breathing, oxygen is not just oxygen. The oxygen we breathe is composed of a mixture of three, mainly three, so-called isotopes, which have almost identical chemical properties, but are very, very slightly different in their magnetic and other processes. Up to now, that's played not so, the vast range of about 3,000 known isotopes, many of them, most of them created artificially in reactors and accelerators. Well, up to now, although in some domains, everybody knows in medicine we use radioactive isotopes and so forth, but the era of an economy which is based on these very fine differences is still to come. Nuclear processes produced isotopes, not simply chemical elements. So, and that means revolutionary, potentially, changes in productive activity and even redefinition of what constitutes a resource. So I wanted to give an indication of this, at least. It's quite important to see that what I'm talking about, and I document this in my paper, is that we're not talking about some kind of science fiction or some kind of dream of something that might happen in a couple of decades. Yes, we need a political revolution to make it happen. But in terms of the basic technologies and principles to get this thing started, they already exist. They're already in various different phases of development. So that in a sense, and Lynn LaRouche took this up in his introduction to my article in the EIR, where he compared this to the John F. Kennedy Apollo program, where the Apollo program had the character that the essentially fundamental technologies that you needed to get to the moon were there. And what had to be done is to put them together with the political will behind it to carry that out as a crash program. So we're in a similar situation, except that when you talk about the isotope economy, the implications, once the thing gets going, are vastly broader than simply a landing on the moon. And perhaps a last comment on that. I mentioned that the isotope economy, an economy where man is creating new species of atoms, is an astrophysical one. Well, it's not simply using some processes that we find in the sun and, you know, in stars, but to keep the isotope economy going, to understand better and better the principles of nuclear physics, which basically are only nuclear physics is in the Stone Age in a certain sense. We can do certain things, but we don't understand it really that well. So to understand it and to continue, you need a continuous stream of discoveries to keep this level of a world economy going. Those discoveries require very extensive investigations of in astrophysics, which we cannot do from the surface of the Earth, and also not just in satellites, which are very close to the surface of the Earth. But we need to establish, in a whole array of orbits around the sun, networks of observation posts, observation satellites, to do really serious astrophysical investigations, and including, of course, the research of the history of the solar system, because when you're looking, as I mentioned, at the solar system, you're looking at the fossil or the end product or preliminary end product of an evolutionary process based on exactly the kinds of principles that we have to master now. We have to stop just speculating in front of computer or internet screens, just as the New World was discovered and developed by going there, and Columbus and others. We have to go out into the universe and get serious about science, and get serious about man's role in the universe and all the work that's waiting for us out there to do. In the meantime, this establishes, in terms of the problems we have right here on the Earth, that with these technologies, if they are mobilized, there is no limits, there are no resource problems for the development of the world economy with 6.5 billion people rising up to 12 billion and more, if we get this science driver going. So that, I guess, is a should give some idea of the basic thrust of my paper, and I can imagine there will be a lot of questions about it. I included a lot of topics also for the purpose of having people, as many as possible, really get excited about this and dig their teeth into various parts of it. It's wide open, and we need a new generation of young people to do for nuclear physics what Kepler did for astronomy, and it can only be done from the basis of reviving, in a sense, methodologically militant way, the rigorous method that Kepler used, and applying that to these scientific problems which I mentioned.
That's great. Thank you. Let me do one thing. It's halftime already, and I just have to make one announcement, and then I do want to turn right away to Peter Martinson in Seattle, who I didn't mention before, is the co-editor of the new publication Jonathan mentioned. This is the first issue, the first number in October, Dunamis. But before that, at halftime, I need to say you are listening to The LaRouche Show, which is weekly on Saturdays from 3 to 4 Eastern Time in the United States. And what I want to do, those of you who listen by telephone, do check the website, which is www.larouchepub.com, LaRouchePub.com. And I also stress to others, to everyone listening, that you stay in touch and on organizing, and that is with citizens, with scientists, with who isn't a scientist, right? But call the Lyndon LaRouche Political Action Committee to stay in touch and see what all you can do. And there is a toll-free number I'd like to give you, 800-929-7566. That's 800-929-7566. So in Seattle, Peter, you may have a question directly for Jonathan. There's many other questions lined up. But also, would you describe, pick up on just what Jonathan said about why you started this new journal, and you can give the website where it is, please.
Yeah, sure. The way I actually wanted to just, like, couch the Dunamis is it didn't really start, you know, a couple months ago when me, Rihanna, and a couple other people in the youth movement decided to actually publish the thing. But it actually started when LaRouche initiated the youth movement about 5 years ago or so, when youth were coming to him saying, basically, we've been brainwashed. We've been, like, denied a real education in science and anything else. And, damn it, we want an education. What do we study? And LaRouche basically gave us the 1799 paper of Gauss to go and master. And since then, a lot of work has developed, and it's branched out into work on Gauss's work on potential, Gauss's work on curvature, and also student Riemann's work on tensors and hypergeometry and so forth. And a good portion of the youth movement is now developing a serious mastery of some of the needed concepts for this kind of modern science that Jonathan's describing. So what we decided is that since people are writing certain things in the youth movement and putting things together and it's not all collected anywhere, we wanted to put together a type of a forum, which could be like a discussion forum within the youth movement, but not like a show-and-tell type of a thing, but a serious scientific journal where the youth can put together reports on different breakthroughs, on different pedagogicals that we found while fighting with, you know, people on the campuses and so forth, and put this stuff all together in a monthly or bi-monthly journal that people can get on our website. We actually have it two places. You can get it at www.seattlelym.com, and there's a link to it there. There's also one on the regular LaRouche Youth Movement website, www.wlym.com. But we intended it to be, LaRouche actually puts it the best because he writes an introductory article in the first issue that what this marks is the reemergence of the Academy of Plato, a type of a Platonic academy where science, which was in the middle of becoming extinct, because if you go to the campuses today, you find out that the youth are pretty, their minds are becoming sterile from the horrible education that they're getting. But what the journal represents is a reemergence of real science. And it's a point of transformation in the youth movement, I think.
Well, let me ask you, could I throw in a few of the one of the questions that come from several waiting on the kind of thing the two of you just been talking about in a concrete sense, from the medical biology area? Because I know there's an article in the new Dynamis on aspects of how to think about living things. But Jonathan, you're talking about isotopes, some 3,000, and you used the example of oxygen, or some people have a concept of this or not. But you're saying in living matter in the body, you think of things that we think of as chemical elements, like calcium or something like that. Is it the case, you report, that some medical scientists find that isotopes seem not to make any difference at all, and then there's the occasional case where something makes a critical, almost life and death difference? Is that accurate?
Well, it's a common kind of anomaly you have, because very often when people look at just statistical effects, and say, this is an exception, but you know, that's only 0.0001% effect, right? It's exactly the things that you wouldn't pick up if you just look at something, a gross effect, which turn out again and again in science to be the determining factor. Just one example. Take a living cell. What is the characteristic that makes it alive? The moment after the cell dies, the molecules are all there, the elements are all there, the mass is the same. So the difference in the change involved is a very apparently small one, which a statistician who's just counting the molecules and weighing them wouldn't even notice. So in this case, there's very, very important work in progress. I took just one example, which was just coming in the last couple of years, work of a school of mainly Russian physical chemists who've been looking at some of the crucial processes involved in living cells, and finding that you have what's called phosphorylation. It's involved the production of a molecule called ATP. Everybody learns or should learn about this.
You see it on diagrams if they do cells,
yeah, yeah,
right?
Yeah. So now to get this thing to work, living processes use a series of enzymes, or proteins. These proteins have what are sometimes called active sites. The key enzymes involve an active site that has one ion of magnesium. And as I said, magnesium is not magnesium. There are different isotopes of magnesium. And the Russian researchers have determined that, in fact, it is the difference between isotopes which is crucial to the functioning of this process. That if you have it's just one atom, one ion. If the ion is one of the isotopes, the process works much faster and much more efficiently and through a different pathway than if it's a different isotope. So that simply establishes an example of something which is just opening a little bit the curtain to a completely different, potentially, understanding of how living processes, even on the chemical level, work. And this is characteristic of living processes. And living processes, the characteristic effect, one aspect of it is that what appears to be a small change is determinant for the entire process. So that's and it can go very far. This is just the very beginning. because we already on a completely different area, even the production of electronic devices, but also key parts for example, machine tools. It's already starting now, will be so fabricated as so-called isotopically engineered materials. That is, instead of the natural so-called the materials you take out of the earth are mixtures of isotopes. Now man is going to begin to change those mixtures and develop materials that are either composed of a pure isotope or a specific mixture or even a specific pattern of isotopes to get materials that have different characteristics, for example, machine tools that are vastly more efficient and more precise and can work at a higher flux density than the ones we have now.
Yeah, I think you used the example of diamonds that would be so many, many times stronger than, so to speak, naturally occurring diamonds.
Yeah, because you have it's musical. It's musical. It's like having a chorus that's this bel canto that is singing on the same technique, that is singing on the right. The youth movement is working on this question of the fine shifts in intonation, which are crucial to the communication of powerful musical ideas. It involves what appear to be just very tiny differences, but they have to be sung by a chorus. So without pushing the analogy to in a linear way, one thinks of the isotopes as a very fine differentiation, apparently. But that's the differentiation which creates the biggest effects. So that's so if you have a material which you're just taking a cacophony of mixture of isotopes, it may not function very well. Heat transmission, very, very simple kind of thing, depends on the acoustical, the oscillational processes going on in the material. And they depend then again on the isotopes, these ions that have different masses, they have different oscillation frequencies. Much finer aspect is the magnetic properties, which is again an apparently small effect, but which, as the Russian work on the physical chemistry of some of these ATP processes shows, they turn out to be the crucial effect. So that's the direction we're going. I mean, it's just beginning now. So I mentioned just a few examples to give people a sense that this is not, again, this has already started. We're in the very beginning phases of a transformation that will be in some ways comparable to what happened from around the middle of the 19th century with this enormous development of chemistry and chemical industry upon which our whole economic activity is based now. We'll be going into beyond the, say, 92 elements into 3,000 or more and generating new isotopes. It's an open-ended process.
Right. Peter, do you want to ask something here, or I can continue?
Sure. Yeah, I got a ton of questions.
Go right ahead.
First thing I wanted to ask is, this is something I've been wondering for a long time. You mentioned in your paper LaRouche's idea of polarized fusion in the early solar system.
Mm-hmm.
And I never really understood exactly what was meant by that, but I get a sense in your paper that it has to do with these magnetic effects of the of ions. I wonder if you could just describe that a little bit.
Well, I think it's broader than that. I mean, at a certain point, you had a problem that already Robert Moon was thinking about in the 1950s, maybe before that, I think, even, and who brought into our discussion quite forcefully when he once was speaking, I think, to LaRouche and just said, look, Mr. LaRouche, modern nuclear physics is a bunch of garbage and that people have the wrong way of going at fusion. You can open up any textbook and it will tell you, well, in fusion you have to bring nuclei together. Nuclei are positively charged, so you have to overcome the so-called Coulomb barrier. The closer they get, the more they repulse, which translates into bringing the material which is supposed to produce the reactions to enormously high temperatures of 1,000 million degrees. So Moon was saying, but this is all based on a dogma of the existence of these so-called Coulomb forces as something fundamental. So At a certain point in the discussion, actually, at the beginning of the 1980s, as I recall, some laboratories in the United States began to look at what happens to a fusion process if you polarize magnetically, you know, sort of think about it as orienting the nuclei in a coherent way before you carry out the fusion process, and found that the process is more efficient. But that was not, that doesn't really yet really express LaRouche's concept as I understand it, because behind the whole thing is a misconception of what these reactions are. And we don't know all that much about it, but we do know, without any question, that what's called a particle, let's say a nucleus, is not a localized entity. A particle is a global entity, which can produce, is something global. There's something acting on the whole universe, a condition of the universe, which has localized effects, but is not itself a localized entity. So therefore, when you're talking about a reaction, you know, you have this picture of these nucleus, little balls knocking into each other. This is not the way the universe works. This is a cartoon, Mickey Mouse version. So therefore, there is no such, a nuclear reaction is not fundamentally a local phenomenon only. It depends upon the entire condition, the geometry, the physical geometry within which the process is operating. So if we think of the polarized and the this very limited experiments that were done before as simply a kind of a metaphor or a first expression of something much, much more fundamental, which comes out in another way now that we know there are now experiments clearly show that the so-called constants of radioactive decay are not constants. If you take a nucleus and you put it in a different environment, it changes its nuclear processes. A radioactive nucleus that takes billions of years to decay will decay suddenly in a few seconds, and so forth. So it's like that, and then important is to see that LaRouche was thinking about this in that kind of historical perspective. I'm talking about history in the really big sense, the prehistory of the Earth, and the anomaly that the fusion reactions that we observe or we think we observe occurring in the sun today, those sorts of reactions would not have been capable in that form of generating the elements that we actually find. And therefore, there must have been something else.
Right. And do you want to continue, Peter?
Yeah, definitely.
Go ahead.
Okay. Just to kind of continue on this stuff, a lot of the work that the youth movement's doing right now is on Kepler. And we've got this group hanging out at LaRouche's house, which is now turning into like a little scientific laboratory. They just blasted through the new astronomy of Kepler, and now they're working on Kepler's world harmonics. And you mentioned that in your paper that the study of atomic and nuclear phenomena and so forth really starts with Kepler. But that, like, completely turns things over for modern nuclear scientists because they think they're looking at something totally small.
Yeah.
That is, like, a giant organization of the universe. So I just wonder if you could kind of develop that a little bit.
Well, I think you have to get – it's the same thing that you're looking at with Gauss, the difference between mathematics and physics. And at least for me – the standpoint of Vernadsky, which is the same as a later of Kepler, of those really great scientific thinkers, you have to start with the whole universe. Most people think, you have to start with a piece of the universe, and then you study one piece, and then you study another piece, and then you study another piece. And then somehow, if you keep doing that, you're going to understand something about the universe. This is nonsense. The Platonic method, which is the method of Kepler, which is implicitly also the method of Vernadsky, the one he, in a sense, grew up with, is the notion that the universe as a whole is the elementary entity. It's presupposed by everything else. So if you look at this from that standpoint, then you look at the solar system, and you don't now do what people generally tend to do. They say, well, okay, well, I'm looking at some planets moving around the sun. No, wait a minute. This is a space-time process. This is a historical development process. That's how Kepler actually looked at it. And therefore, if you look at it from that standpoint, you don't say, oh, well, the chemical elements, that's a different field. You have astronomy, and then you have the chemical elements. That's a different speciality. No, wait a minute. You're dealing with one universe, one negentropic process, anti-entropic process, that involves a series of interacting principles. But they all flow from a single, let's say, idea or a single development principle of the entire universe. So, therefore, this way of looking at it, then all these divisions, you know, all these walls that are built, which actually imprison the mind, you have to wipe them away, and look at that when we're looking at the solar system, it's not the object that's important. We're looking at an expression of universal principles. So if they're universal, they're expressed in many ways. So we could keep the we look at the object. We look at everything as an expression. So and then you see immediately the relevance of Kepler's approach on this question, which is still actually we haven't come farther than Kepler on this issue of these small shifts, which he was looking at in terms of the harmonies between the orbits and the harmony of the entire system of the orbits, and the fact that each planet is adjusting to the entire system. Each orbit is reflecting the whole system, and you have something which Kepler immediately implied is something analogous and actually developing in the same kind of way to a polyphonic piece of music. But you don't see the principles. You see these apparently small shifts. It's the human mind only that can conceive and say, okay, well, what's actually generating these shifts? It's not in the solar system. It's not in the object. But it's outside the object. And then we find that that if we're looking at the very small differences, so-called mass defects and other things in nuclear physics, they were actually looking at the same kind of thing. And they're interrelated in the way I mentioned. You're dealing with an astrophysical, the solar system is an we're living with the children of a star in a certain sense. So,
I was wondering, because earlier in the 20th century, there was this, it looked like there were kind of two trains of thought, trains of investigation of nuclear processes, with like Planck, Schrodinger, Einstein, and then on the other side, these people like Bohr. And you talk about Heisenberg in your paper, but Heisenberg was, I thought, was one of Bohr's cronies. But what I was wondering is, do Planck, Schrodinger, and Einstein, were they, I know that they had certain problems, but did they think in this way, like they were looking at something that's actually an astrophysical process, do you think?
Well, they were certainly closer to it because it's like what we observe, you know, the scientific culture out of which that they were coming was much, relatively speaking, much more healthy. But there was already a big degeneration going on that occurred in the second half of the 19th century already. So the attacks on the Riemann, Gauss, Weber school coming from Helmholtz. Coming from Kelvin and so on. So there are all these operations going on. So I think a distinctive feature of what the youth movement has in front of it is, in a certain sense, not to just go back to these very admirable figures and what they did, that's important, but in a certain sense, I mentioned that I called it methodological militancy, to actually reestablish not only what it means to be a good scientist and to think in a good and effective and creative way, but actually a renaissance, actually to go back and recover consciously the method itself, the principle of creativity itself. So that all these figures, they have their very, very good points and less good points for various reasons. Einstein, perhaps more than the others, was working at trying to get understand what was this Riemann thing about, how to look at the whole universe. But generally, and perhaps that's an aspect that we can somehow that we judo of the mess the world's in right now, is that it forces us in a certain sense to go for nothing less than a revolution, and nothing less than an intellectual, cultural, and political revolution, nothing less than a renaissance. So all those figures are mixed. Heisenberg is an interesting case because he came under the influence. He was a young guy. I think in a certain sense in the 1920s you had a little bit of something like the boomer phenomenon. A young guy who came under the influence of the sort of patrician Bohr and others, but toward the end of his life particularly, he began to rethink and see how the whole field that he'd been working on was going into insanity. And he reflects that there. And also he had, I think it was his father who was actually a Greek scholar, and he began to go back and read Plato. And this last piece that I quote of, which is actually the last thing that was published, he goes back and said, look, we're on the wrong track.
Peter, do you have, let me just throw in here one thing you said earlier about we've sunk so low that people will think the universe is made up of little particles, and you use the expression, they think the only way then to make things change is you have a kind of Rambo effect. You need strong forces to smash them against each other. And that's what happens in fission power and so forth. But let me ask you, you're also reviewing in so many areas of technology, so to speak, like machine tools, medicine, or the kind of hybrid nuclear reactors we could have. This is very provocative to say, even though we're in a stone age of conceptualization, we still have things we can get right down to and do. Is that the idea?
Well, we have to. we don't have time now. We have to get a mobilization started. I use the metaphor as like you want to insert the world into a better orbit. So the first thing is you have to get the orbit started. Right, and that just is just the beginning, but you have to do that. And I made the point is we have sufficient resources, we have sufficient knowledge, even though it's very limited, to get to a point where we can make the next step. And that's also what you always have in life, right? You want to always get to the point where the next step and the step after that is accessible. So to make it accessible, fortunately, we have what it takes if we have a mobilization with it. Not something in 20 years, but already today, the elements are there. Similar to what Kennedy said, you know, before the decade is out, we're going to land a man on the moon and return him safely to Earth. So in a similar situation, we have fission. We have also very, very improved forms of fission. We have fusion reactors, experimental ones that are already in the parameter range where we can already do things with fusion fission. We have fusion torch possibilities. We have accelerator possibilities. We have these breakthroughs with isotopes. We have laser isotope separation, etc., etc., etc. So those elements are there. So that's the way I look at it. It's like a multi-stage rocket. But you first have to get out there.
And in that sense, the people... let me just ask you one specific thing. It came up in either on your last webcast in Berlin, but someone in Moscow was saying, well, we have a lot of natural resources still that we could find on Earth. Were they talking about making them? That's a paradox, you know, man-made natural resources or more things to discover. What did they mean?
Well, see, I think in all of these things, I look at this all as science is one. So... although from the standpoint of the predicates, there seems to be a big difference between having an improved mining methods
uh-huh.
or improved methods which these Russians are using for actually using the knowledge of the history of the Earth to guess, so to speak, in a much, much better way using satellites and all kinds of indications, even the colors of tree leaves.
For deposits and so forth.
Where deposits are.
Mm-hmm.
That on the one side is inseparable in a sense, from the kind of development I'm talking about or emphasizing, with a plasma torch, where you can put essentially anything into a plasma and get pure isotopes out in the limit, and the creation of specific isotopes and material. So it will be it's an orchestra. It's a mix that we're looking for. So the Russians were making the point that the present, hyperinflation of prices of raw materials that have been going on is artificial. Does not mean the raw materials are running out tomorrow.
Right.
It is true that we require more work to get them. And eventually you get to a point where it becomes actually, in many cases, actually more effective and economically less costly to produce a species of atoms than to mine it, even though there's, in principle, a lot of the stuff still there.
Well, I think you've brought it all together. I can't believe the hour has gone. So, and I want to thank Peter Martinson, Jonathan Tenenbaum. And this is the discussion that we invite everyone to engage in, be in touch with everyone. Call the number I mentioned in the United States. It's toll-free, 800-929-7566. And I thank Doris for the email from Washington. We'll get to that off the air. And we're looking forward to inserting the world into the new orbit. Thank you very much, and please listen again October 14th for the LaRue Show. Thank you.